E2, number 22A.
Let's just see a few more examples about Nahum, for instance, just to show how the arguments of error, that error can be tenacious, is being refuted by the Christ impact. We had their mind, we went through mind. Then let's, for instance, take spirit. Spirit is constantly coming to human consciousness. You see, the Christ coming to the point of consciousness as the only reality. And now what does it refute? It refutes the belief that error is more real and there's more substance and stability than spiritual ideas. Can you see what the argument is always? That the error can be more powerful, more real than God, than the synonymous term. Or let's take soul. Soul is constantly coming to human consciousness as true identification. See, as that which really can show in a situation what's going on, can really identify and name a situation, and so refutes the belief that error can hide itself through subtlety and disguise without being detected by soul. Can you see what the argument is? That error says, that the counterfeit of soul says, I cannot be detected, I cannot be analyzed by soul, I can be not named and defined by soul, I can hide myself, that soul will not find me out. You see? That's the argument of subtlety, the counterfeit of soul, that says, I can hide myself and therefore fool God. Soul will never find me out. Truth will never find out how much erroneous the situation is. Can you see? Can you see that in practice? That in practice you have to deal with a situation where it just seems, I can't get at the whole thing. It is just as if the error could hide himself and disguise itself so that I never find out what it is. This is Nahum, the law of Nahum that says, oh, but if I see that the whole of soul is constantly coming to every situation as what? As that true identification, at that true naming, at that true defining, then error has no chance to hide it. And so escape, really, the destruction of soul. See? Or let's take one of principle. Principle is constantly coming to human consciousness as the one and only interpretation. Refuting what? The belief that through personal interpretation, scholastic theories, worldly opinion, error can wield more authority than God. Can you see that? That the Nahum is that one which says, look here, the belief is that any other science, medical science, physical science, chemical science, psychological science, biological science, can give you much more interpretation of what is happening than the interpretation of principle. That's the argument, you see, that says, why do you need divine science? Go and study the various sciences. They interpret much clearer what is going on. That's Nahum. See? That says, I can stand up against God. I can stand up against principle. I can refute that principle is more powerful, that principle can interpret better than the other sciences. Can you hear the tone? That is completely different than in Hosea or in life. Life is constantly coming to human consciousness as true being, refuting what? The belief that error has existence, life, continuity, and that it cannot be suppressed and extinguished by God. Can you see? The belief is that there is error that has more life than the life of God. That the body has more life than the life of God. Saying, there is more life in all human existence than in the divine life. And therefore that organic life can refute, really, the divine life and can say, error can say, I have so much life that you, life, capital L, can do nothing to me. You can't kill me. You can't kill error's life. Error will go on and on and on and will live. And life, capital L, cannot come and destroy it. Can you see the tone? Always the belief that the opposite of God is invincible, cannot be conquered, that it is much stronger than God. These are the arguments which we meet every day, that we say something which is not God has more life, has more intelligence, has more substance than God. And that is how we can go, say, through all the seven synonymous terms and just go along that law, and by doing that and going over it and take a quarter of an hour, half an hour, just to go right through it, you will feel that this naturally builds up within you a consciousness which says there is nothing that can withstand the impact of the Christ. Just nothing. There is nothing, neither counterfeit of mind, nor the counterfeit of spirit, nor the counterfeit of soul, nor the counterfeit of principle, or of life, or truth and love, that can withstand the impact of the Christ. The idea is preserved. That idea can never be destroyed. Yes. Well, I don't know if you got the tone or not, but I pointed it out. And as it is a science, and as it is a big science, and it is a science of life, one jolly well has to make up one's mind to live with these laws for a while, until they become tangible and real and warm, spiritually tangible, that they become identified, that you begin to see the difference between each other. And if... Say you had a feeling during these last 2 hours or so that you can't quite distinguish these laws, then this is the proof that you should study them, because it shows that one's mentality is not structured, and therefore is a proof that we will not be able to detect fundamental errors, that everything is mixed up in one's consciousness and just says, this is error, this is not good. But you cannot put your finger on it and say, what is the argument? And these laws culture oneself in structuring one's consciousness to see how error is structured. What are the beliefs of error, and therefore be able to attack them in a more precise way, in a more consistent way. Yes, that's that. So we go to the epistles. And we take the epistle book and open it up at page 42. And we look at the Christianity matrix and ask ourselves now some fundamental questions about that matrix. And by asking those fundamental questions, we naturally will find out how very much this matrix differs from the Christ matrix. So again, that we feel this matrix is really very definitely distinguishable from any other matrix, and that its purpose and its application and its practice is completely on a different level. Now, let's look at it and see if this matrix fulfills the demands of a matrix. We go and said, in order that it fulfills the demand of a matrix, the indices must be consistent. If it is a Christianity matrix, then naturally both indices must have a Christianity tone. And so we first take the index I and see first if we can feel that those four verticals have actually a touch of word, then Christ, then Christianity, and science. So we take the first vertical, the grace of God. Don't look at me, look at the book. It's in the book. The grace of God. Would you say that the grace of God has a word touch? I would say, oh yes, it has to do about God. The moment I ask something about the nature of God, I'm always at the point of the word. If we take the next column, the glory of Christ, I think this is rather clear too, that it has to do with the Christ, the glory of the Christ. And if we come to the third, to Christianity, and I said it is the idea of man's perfection, I guess you see at once very easily that this is at the point of Christianity, at the point of idea, of perfect idea, man as perfect idea. So already here we have a current flow from God, Christ, idea. That's always the fundamental flow. And in the fourth column, we have the science of man, again showing science. So that is the way we would have to investigate the finding and say, does it really bring forth a ordered matrix? But you would have to ask still another question. We would have to ask, are these terms depicting the four on the same level, or does the level change of these terms? And so we can ask, has it, for instance, an absolute or a relative connotation? If I take the word again and say it's the grace of God, then I can see that it is from the absolute point that the nature of God is graceful. So I could say, yes, it has an absolute connotation. The glory of Christ. And the second one, I could say, yes, again, this doesn't take in something that is discordant or small or little or lacking. It's actually, again, a very absolute sense. When I go to the Christianity, the idea of man's perfection, again, I would say this is absolute. It has no relation to anything relative, to anything that has to do with a mortal. And I would find again that it has an absolute connotation. And so also with the science of man, giving a science about the idea man. Can you see how I check the findings, not if I like it or not, or what I think it's nice? I always check the findings according to the system itself. I let the system decide if the findings are consistent or not. Yeah? The system is here, is the index always on the same level? And here I find, yes, it's on the same level. So apparently we don't have to make any changes here. They are all on the absolute level. I would go a step further in order to find out if this index is right. Why? I must also ask another question, namely, do all these four terms conform to what? To the A of the matrix. Do they all express a Christianity sense? Or do they change from the word sense to the science sense to the word sense and so on? All these four must have the impress of Christianity, or it wouldn't be a Christianity matrix. Can you see that? By golly, you have to see that. Huh? Now let's see. Does the grace of God in the Word, has grace a Christianity sense? Very much so. Huh? You feel touched by it. Huh? Has the glory of Christ a Christianity touch? Yeah. Huh? Very much so. And the idea of man's perfection, anyway, huh? You have perfection, man's perfection as idea. And again, when there's a Christianity touch, and when it comes to science, and I say it's a science of man, I have a Christianity touch. It's not just science. It's not just the science of ideas. It's the science of man. Huh? It's not the science of God. It's not the science of being, capital B. It's the science of man, Christianity. Do you see that if I would only have put there Word, Christ, Christianity, science, it wouldn't yield much truth content, because I wouldn't know what kind of Word I mean, what kind of Christ I mean, what kind of Christianity I mean. Do I mean a Christianity that is absolute or relative? Do I mean a Christianity or a Christ that is has the impress of the matrix of Christianity or not? Okay, so we would have to go and check our index J, and would have to go through those four and ask the very same questions. Would have to ask first, is accepting the new faith a word sense? I would say, yes. The word sense is that you go and approach God and accept God as what He is. Would you say that claiming the new faith has a Christ sense? Very much so. Huh? If you have a spiritual ear, you know that the Christ is that where we accept, where we claim our unity with God, huh? Where we claim what is, where we make it our own. That's the Christ sense in the human. What about steadfastly abiding in the new faith? Is steadfastly abiding in the new faith a Christianity sense? Yes. Yeah, huh? You're not quite sure here. And I think it's not quite clear, because we really should see here too something that is bigger than just abiding, because He always shows here in C, they always show that by steadfastly abiding in the new faith, we will win a victory. They always show that. So I shortened that. But actually within yourself you should know that the tone that runs through that is saying, you know, like in the Beatitude, if you stay with a divine attitude and don't waver, you get the reward. You get the victory. So all those epistles on that horizontal actually show you that steadfastly abiding by that new faith wins a victory. And the moment I say that, you know it is Christianity, because it's demonstration. Yes? And if you go down to science, where we have put proving the new faith by living it, you get the sense, yes, this is naturally science, it's the proof. So that we would find, yes, the four horizontals are actually pinpointing attitudes of Word, Christ, Christianity, and science. So we would have to come to the further test. What is the further test? Further test would be to test if they are absolute or relative or mixed up. So we go again through it and ask ourselves, are they absolute or relative? If I say accepting the new faith, I know at once it is relative, because I accept it. Not God does accept it. I accept it, and I know it is my relative attitude. Claiming the new faith in the Christ, I see, this is relative. I claim it. God doesn't claim it. I claim the new faith. If I go to Christianity and see that I have to be steadfast in abiding by the new faith, I also see that it is relative. There are qualities I have to show forth. Can you see that? And actually the last one, proving the new faith by living it, is very relative. I have to live it. So they would all show, therefore, the force in the relative. Again, we would have to ask the last test, namely, do they all have a Christianity sense in it? Are you with me? Yeah? Has accepting the new faith, the Christianity in it? Oh, yes. Huh? You do something. And claiming the new faith has all to do with Christianity, what we do, actually do. And steadfastly abiding, again, is Christianity, and living it is again Christianity. You just get the whole sense of what the Christianity sense in the human implies, as were Christ, Christianity, and science. So that actually we can see, this is a matrix that seems to conform to all the requirements of a matrix. And if I look at it and say, now, what is it all about, that Christianity? You know, in the Christ we said it has to do with God coming to men. But in Christianity, naturally, the tone must be something else than God coming to men. It must be a Christianity sense. And what is it? And I think what the epistles show is actually just that. Namely, what is, so to say, man's reciprocal relationship to God. Therefore, the absolute sense of God to man and man to God. Or I would say the reciprocal relation that man has towards what? That man has towards the absolute Word, the absolute Christ, the absolute Christianity, and the absolute science. Doing what? That brings forth another relationship, namely the relationship of the Word, Christ, Christianity, and science to men. That's why these epistles have all to do with the life of men. What constitutes really a true Christianity, a human Christianity, based on a Christianity of the idea. That's why these epistles are so alive and give us the style of life, the true style of life, because they show what is man's relationship to those four, and what do those four do to men? What do I get out of it? And that's constantly the case within those epistles. And it's just a matter of going through those epistles and seeing what they really want to show. But you may not by heart know what is in each epistle. And actually, before I go through it, I would like you perhaps to enlarge on those indices so as to give you a bit a better workable sense of each one of those four. And so I go first through the index I and enlarge on the term there so that you get a more warmer, rounder sense of it. For instance, I have written there in the word the grace of God. And what is meant by it? You see, I always try to write it down as short as possible. But what it meant, and you can write that down for yourself, that the grace of God brings out in us, really, God's image and likeness. That's the grace of God that is shown there. That the grace of God comes and brings to us, so to say, God's image and likeness. In the second vertical, the glory of Christ, that glory really means in those epistles that it is imbuing us with the fullness of the Christ Spirit.